Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Today. Uwe Simonetto joins us here in just a moment. We're going to be getting our religion roundup, talking largely about what Pope Benedict XVI, some people have raised questions about his Nazi past. He was a member of the Nazi youth. We'll find out what that really means here at the beginning of our conversation with Uwe. Then, in about 20, 25 minutes, Doug Johnson of National Right to Life joins us. There is a bill working its way through the House and on to the Senate called the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act. Now, this bill would, as far as I can tell, make it illegal for anyone to transport a minor across state lines for the purpose of getting an abortion if the original state has a law pertaining to parental notification. It would require, at the very least, that the abortion provider notify the parents before an abortion takes place across state lines. We'll find out the details of that act and, sounds like, pending legislation in about 20 minutes with Doug Johnson of National Right to Life. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto joins us for our religion roundup. He's religious affairs editor for United Press International. Uwe, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Uwe, one of the biggest questions that was raised early on when Cardinal Ratzinger was elected Pope Benedict XVI was not only the fact that he was a German, but the fact that he had at some time in his youth been in the Nazi youth. Tell us about the details.
Well, he was very briefly in the Hitler Youth, which was compulsory after 1941, as far as I can recall, for every German above the age of 10 to be enrolled in that. It was depending on how you look at it, it was either the Nazi Party's equivalent of the Boy Scouts, or it was a paramilitary organization, very similar also to the Young Pioneers in the communist days and others. He was in there, and he was enrolled in there, actually by his school. Again, I reiterate, it was compulsory. The school enrolled in there, and he managed to get out of it, saying it was incompatible with being in a pre-seminary school and in a political youth movement, even though it was compulsory.
So
he dropped out.
So young Joseph Ratzinger was in the same position that just about every young man in Nazi Germany was during that time.
Every boy, yeah. Every boy or girl. The girls went into. They had their own movement. Yes, it was that. And then, of course, later on, he was drafted. And let me say something here, because I mean, I got very irate. I followed this very, very carefully on the internet among the bloggers, and especially in the New York Times. I must say, a damnable thing in the New York Times online service, where he was. Where readers then accused him of being a Nazi pope, and Maureen Dowd, who used to be an original writer, no longer is, couldn't have anything better to write about than saying that this kid was in the Hitler Youth, which he was. The same thing has happened in the 1980s when a friend of mine, Jack Kohler, was named communications director of the White House under President Reagan. And some American journalist, I mean, he himself was American, of course. He used to be the general manager of the Associated Press. And he was a war hero. He had been very, very courageous in the Korean War, fighting, of course, in the American military. And he was hounded out of the White House again by the American journalists for having been in the Hitler Youth at the age of 10, or the equivalent of the Hitler Youth actually was called Jungvolk. That was pre-Hitler Youth, same thing that Ratzinger identity was in, for 6 months, and then dropped out of it. So, I mean, it is a total ill will, of course, that has been brought up against, at the time, Jack Kohler. And he left the White House in disgust and said, well, there's no point. He offered his resignation to President Reagan because the media in the United States in a very, very self-righteous way, made an issue of it, and a major issue, which would have damaged Reagan White House. Same thing happened again now with this Pope. It was very quickly dropped because, interestingly enough, the B'nai B'rith, you know, the Anti-Defamation League, plus the Jerusalem Post, plus the Central Council of Jews in Germany, came out in favor of Cardinal Ratzinger, saying that he was very clean, very clear in his position against the Holocaust, against anti-Semitic outrages, for reconciliation between Jewish and non-Jewish Germans, etc., etc., etc. It was something that's been cooked up by the American media and principally by the New York Times.
So how do you account for then... we can't account for the internet because bloggers will write what bloggers will write.
This was
the New York Times. How do you account?
That was the New York Times online service, their reader service, and I checked with them, and I said, "Well, how come you let? Isn't there anybody editing that? You know, we're not talking about bloggers here. Now we're talking about that." I checked with them, and their communications director said, "Well, we didn't think it was such a big issue." And I responded, and in fact, I wrote and said, "Well, wait a minute." Here's somebody, if you use the N-word for somebody who was black, and the N-word simply describing the color of his skin, you would rightly be accused of racism. If you used any other thing, but if it's a German, you can simply, for the very fact that he's a German, accuse him of being a Nazi. And a Nazi is, by anybody's standards, a mass murderer, a genocidal swine. And that is what the New York Times did. But they always do that sort of thing. It's quite disgusting.
So the New York Times director of public relations says, we choose not to censor such posts unless they are abusive, defamatory, or obscene.
Yeah, we didn't find that particularly abusive, you see. It's very funny that, you know, if I went around in the street and said, well, hey, you, you're a mass murderer, you know that? I mean, imagine I said this to an abortionist. You know, you're a baby killer. He'd have me locked up and beaten up and gone as well. I'd be in jail. They call a totally innocent guy who was a child at the time a mass murderer, because that's what a Nazi is, a mass murderer. Called him a mass murderer when, in fact, this guy, Cardinal Ratzinger, had a family history. His father was a dedicated anti-Nazi, which is why he was a cop, he could not progress within the police force because he did not want to live up to Nazi standards, and so he was moved from village to village to village. You know, he was a village cop, in other words. Ratzinger himself was raised anti-Nazi. He made sure to drop out of the Hitler Youth, which was exceedingly difficult at the time. Because it was compulsory, you know, he got out of it by saying it is incompatible with my Catholic beliefs, and so therefore out he went. He was then drafted into the anti-aircraft gunners. What we call it? These were kids. I remember them. I mean, people in my school who were 14, 15, were drafted, and they were all killed. Thousands of them were killed. I mean, nobody is allowed to say nowadays that this was a crime, but it was a crime. You take kids off the street, off the school, stick them in uniform, and make them shoot at foreign airplanes, which are bombing you. If that's not a crime, I wonder what is. This is what happened to him. He was then, when this was over, drafted into the labor movement. They had a pre-military labor force, which is where people, young men, were trained in a military sort of sense, except they wore spades rather than guns. And then pretty soon he was drafted into the army and deserted, and then spent several, deserted to the Americans, and the Americans then put him into a POW camp for several months.
Now, I read your columns and your analysis leading up to the election of Ratzinger, and things, according to what you were posting before he was elected, you kind of saw this coming. Why did you consider Ratzinger a front runner when everyone else was rather unsure?
Well, I considered him a front runner because I had some very, very good sources inside the Vatican. I knew that Ratzinger was by far the most recognized internationally as the most superior theologian or staff, the most knowledgeable member of the papal curia, most highly respected, and also a disciplinarian who could bring order into the Vatican, which is one shortcoming of the previous pope. I think we discussed this in John Paul II's days, that, I mean, one of his shortcomings was that although he was a wonderful apostle to the world, he was not a very good disciplinarian. Ratzinger was. And furthermore, there was a need in the Vatican for a continuation of the Pope's program, the last Pope's program, and primarily, and which is something that even now people don't seem to understand, why Ratzinger was chosen. You know, they always take this whole tech as if this were a presidential election, and you have to have a presidential candidate from the north, and that balanced off with a presidential candidate from the south. So, you know, it should reflect the makeup of your constituency, which is not what happens in a church, or should not happen in a church. Of course, the Catholics say that it's the Holy Spirit who determines, therefore God who determines who becomes the newest pope, and it is infinitely more important to have Europe re-Christianized than to have a representative of the the southern hemisphere, especially South America or Africa, where Christianity is burgeoning with or without a South American or Latin American or African pope. So they need somebody to address the tailspin of Europe, the spiritual tailspin, and bring this back. And this is why this pope is chosen. And of course, he made it very, very clear from the word go that this was, and the choice of his name, Benedict, the patron saint of Europe, that the re-evangelization of Europe was probably the most important, and by extension also North America, the most important task the church had to pursue, because the other parts of the world are doing very well, thank you. It is, and that, by the way, applies to Protestantism as well. It is Europe and it's North America where the issues are.
So when we look at this particular pope,
yeah,
do we see, at least in retrospect, a recognition that Europe is in many ways theologically, spiritually bankrupt,
yeah,
and that the center of theological gravity, at least in the Catholic Church, has shifted to the southern hemisphere?
I wouldn't call it theological gravity. The center of growth. Church growth, not church growth in the sense that there's been criticism. The center of faith has shifted to the global south, both in the Catholic Church and in Protestant churches, Lutheran, Anglican, what have you. Theologically, the North, and especially Europe, are not quite as bankrupt as it seems to be, because you have exceedingly good theologians in Europe, both on the Catholic and the Protestant side, Ratzinger being doubtless the most important Catholic theologian in Europe as we speak. But on the Lutheran side, you have equally good people, very Orthodox, very good Christians. The bankruptcy of the theological faculties was an event that occurred in the 1970s, 60s, earlier on that time. That is no longer the case to that extent that it used to be. The problem lies with bad church leadership, especially in Germany, among the Protestants, but all the Catholics, they are very wobbly in many ways. It is the liberals, as it were, have moved into church leadership positions, whereas actually the faculties are doing much better now and are producing much better and much more faithful seminarians and young theologians as we speak than they did, say, 20, 30 years ago.
Uwe, you have written recently, in fact, I think as of yesterday, about the possibility that Benedict XVI will take part in what you call a reform of the reform, that is to reverse the triviality to which the Mass, that is the Roman Catholic Mass, had been descended after the Second Vatican Council.
Yes.
What do you see that indicates this?
Well, first of all, one thing is the return to the Tridentine liturgy, to the Latin liturgy, which is infinitely more beautiful than what has come out of Vatican II, which also transcended into parts of the Protestant churches, Lutheran and Anglican. I mean, just if you know this and also with you, you know, Lord be with you, and also with you, well, with you too, you know, this is so so trivial. But it's just one sign. That is one thing. It is taking Mass, taking the Eucharist for what it is, namely the center of Christian worship, especially in a liturgical sense, and as we would say, being an equal pillar to the proclamation of the word. These things have been stressed. I mean, Ratzinger, and together with John Paul II, but especially Ratzinger stressed this over and over and over again in his ministry, as the prefect of the congregation for the doctrine of faith. So that is visible. The church, Latin is coming back. High liturgy is coming back. You also found, I mean, the Pope, for example, only said Mass in Latin during the funeral masses in Rome. At one point, he preached in Latin even, but this also goes hand in glove with a revival of Latin in the Western world, especially here in this country. I mean, you have Latin and you have colleges that are doing very, very well indeed, and where Latin has become very important again. So there is a sense, there is a return to the classics, which is what we're talking about, to history, the return to sound theology. I found it also very interesting that this Pope mentioned the Virgin only in passing. I followed his sermons very carefully and also reread them again. These were very evangelical sermons. They were very Bible-centered and doctrinally very sound. Catholic sermons, obviously, but I mean, they were sound. They weren't wobbly and all over the map. So in that sense, he is very important, and I think we're going to see much more of that.
Now, I noted in the sermon that Ratzinger delivered prior to his election of Pope at the funeral mass for Pope John Paul II, Mary had a stronger role to play, especially in the last two paragraphs. We actually listened to that on the air, and I don't know if it was an homage to John Paul II and his Marian emphasis, or whether or not it was reflective of Ratzinger intending to carry on the strong Mariology that had been so much a part of John Paul II, but it was definitely there in that sermon.
In that sermon, towards the end, I noticed that, but it was not the center of a sermon. It was much less the center of the sermon as it was under John Paul II, and it did not continue into future sermons.
Hmm.
You know, and that is very important. Also, look, the Poles are very Mariological, as we all know. And John Paul II was exceedingly so. In Ratzinger's theology of what I've read, it does not go beyond what you might read in many of Luther's sermons on the Virgin Mary.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see, based on encyclicals and other emphases, where he will end up on the question of Mary.
Yeah.
Uwe, before we let you go, there was today issued a report from the Missouri School of Journalism in Columbia, Missouri, not far from here, that showed, and I'll just quote a bit of the report and then, of course, some statistics, consumers of American journalism respect, value, and need journalism, but they are skeptical about whether journalists really live up to the standards of accuracy, fairness, and respect for others. large majorities show that they think journalism is a force for good, that they benefit from it, that it helps them understand what's going on in America. But then there are equally large percentages that believe that there's a bias in journalism and that journalists too often invade privacy and that journalism is too negative. Your thoughts on this report?
Yeah, well, it's absolutely true. Both sides are right. I mean, journalism must be a force for good simply by otherwise you cannot have a democracy unless you have good journalism reports. There is an arrogance. There's a journalistic hubris that, again, came out of the 1960s, especially in the major media in this country, where the journalists take themselves more seriously than the people they're reporting about. And this, of course, causes distrust, rightly so, by the way, that people distrust those types of journalists. When people pontificate before they actually start writing. Again, to bring us back to your first question about the, quote, Nazi issue on the Pope, I mean, this was spread all over the media here without these guys actually even knowing what the Hitler Youth was. You know, they didn't even bother to research. They just wanted to say something negative, and of course, then they suddenly find themselves with their pants down because they realize that they've been acting like fools.
So, Uwe, with only 30 seconds, how much of that in journalism is not so much the result of bias, but of not doing good journalism? That is, not going through the steps that it takes to discover, to background, to check out sources. Basically, lazy journalism.
Well, it goes hand in glove. Bias is always the result of lack of information, of stupidity. As Goethe said, arrogance is a sign of stupidity, and so therefore, lazy journalists not informing themselves properly create bias. First of all, portray bias, bring bias across to the public at large, and then try to create bias, and that is disastrous. And can ultimately destroy the democracy, because if nobody can trust the source of information anymore, then you will no longer have an informed public, and then the sovereign of a democracy, namely the people, will no longer be able to function properly as sovereign, namely as electors.
Uwe Simonetto is Religious Affairs Editor for United Press International. As usual, Uwe, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
When we come back from this break, Doug Johnson of National Right to Life is going to join us, a conversation we had earlier today about this very important Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act, H.R. 748. Now, in the course of this conversation, I want you to listen carefully when we come back from this break, what Doug has to say not only about the act — it's a pretty important federal piece of legislation going to the House and then on to the Senate — but also about what you can do to help push the Interstate Abortion Notification Act through the Senate, where it will probably have its hardest time. And then we'll have a few minutes at the end of the program for some final thoughts. Doug Johnson, Legislative Director of National Right to Life, when we come back from this break. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We'll be talking about the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act right after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
You might be tempted to think that the basic teachings of the Christian faith, the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, Scripture's teaching on baptism, absolution, and the Lord's Supper, are the kind of things that you learn when you're a new Christian. But as you mature, you go on to bigger and better things. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Lord Will Answer, a daily prayer catechism, grounds you in the essentials of the Christian faith in your daily devotions. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, and order the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Lord Will Answer. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Right there on our homepage, you'll find information on the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Lord Will Answer.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. What's right for you might not be right for me. It's all relative, isn't it? At least that's the message we hear time and again in the media. Haven't we all seen characters on TV who claim that it is the height of arrogance and narrow-mindedness to think that you know the truth and those who disagree with you are wrong? But Bible-believing Christians do know the truth, not about everything, but about God and the love that He has shown us in Christ Jesus. We know these things because we know the Bible is the Word of God. Remind your children when they see TV characters floundering about in a sea of moral relativism, we Christians are different. We have the sure rock of Jesus and His Word to build our lives on. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
E.T., we're still listening.
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the writers and editors for Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, you're talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI, correct?
Well, good guess, Mark. You see, a generous donor gave SETI $13.5 million to help fund the search for extraterrestrial life. Now, SETI said the donation will be used to create a radio telescope made up of more than 200 satellite dishes to listen to signals from space. Now, the donor was Paul Allen, a co-founder with Bill Gates of Microsoft. In giving this donation, Allen said, quote, "An instrument of this magnitude will result in the expansion of our understanding of how the universe was formed and how it has evolved and our place therein," unquote. Why would anyone give $13.5 million to this search? It's because they think if life evolved on Earth, well, it must have evolved elsewhere too. They're desperate to prove evolution because they don't want to believe they're responsible to the Creator God of the Bible. You know what's sad? So much money is being spent on trying to find intelligence in outer space when all you have to do is examine our DNA, the molecule of heredity, and realize that a great intelligence has to be responsible for this coded information system called DNA. It's obvious God created.
We'll provide you with more information that confirms the Bible's accuracy when you go to our website, AnswersRadio.com. Read our new booklet on astronomy and the Bible at AnswersRadio.com.
Did God give us the Ten Commandments so that we would have rules to follow, thus earning His favor? Or did He give us the Ten Commandments, the whole law for that matter, to kill us? We talked about that earlier today on the Bible study with Pastor Mark Hawkinson in the connection of 2 Corinthians chapter 3. If you missed it, tune to the Bible study repeat tonight at 7:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Normally, in our federal system, you comply with the law of the state you're in. Your home state laws don't follow you around in a little backpack as you move from one state to another. It's not about parents. It's certainly not about teens' health. It's about an anti-abortion agenda and trying to close the noose on teenagers being able to access abortion when they need it.
That's Nancy Northrup. She's from the National Center for Reproductive Rights, commenting on the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act that is being considered by the House of Representatives as we speak. Now, this is a controversial act because it would rein in a lot of abortions that take place, especially here in the St. Louis area. What do we have happening? Stricter abortion laws in Missouri, very lax, if any, abortion laws in Illinois. People cross state lines, not only adults, but adults with minors and minors with minors crossing state lines to procure abortions. We'll find out here in a conversation with Doug Johnson exactly what the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act is all about. Doug Johnson is Legislative Director for National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. I talked with him earlier today, and I began by asking him about the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act. What is it?
Well, this deals with the problem of minors who are taken across state lines to get abortions without their parents knowing anything about it. You know, about half the states have laws on the books that require at least one parent to be notified before a minor daughter is given an abortion, but Congress has gathered evidence that in many parts of the country, these laws are very frequently circumvented by adults taking those minors to other states, neighboring states, where they don't have the parental notification requirements. So this federal bill that the House is voting on would make it a federal offense to take a minor across state lines if this deprives her parent of the right that they have under state law. And it would also require that the abortionist himself notify a parent in the home state unless the minor fell into a couple of very any of a couple of very carefully crafted exceptions.
So, as in the case here in the St. Louis area, since Missouri does have a parental notification law and Illinois does not, if someone, according to this law, if it were to pass, someone were to transport a minor across state lines from Missouri to Illinois for an abortion, it would require notification.
That's right. The abortionist in Illinois would be required to notify the parent back in Missouri that he was preparing to do an abortion on the minor. This would have to be at least 24 hours in advance. Or he would have to receive a documentation from the minor that she had gone to a state court and received a waiver from the court, which is already permitted under state law. Now, the only other exceptions would be if she was the victim of sexual abuse, she could inform the doctor of that, but then he would be required to notify a state child abuse agency instead of the parent. Or if it was a true case of her life being in danger, but that would be extraordinarily rare, if ever. There's an exception for that as well. So the general rule would be that a parent would be notified, or at least that the minor would have to have gone before a judge. And so this would be very different from the current situation, where you have a lot of cases where girls, even very young girls, 13 and 14, are often pressured to go across the state lines, pressured in some cases by their boyfriends, who are often much older, or others who have reasons for wanting them to have abortions, and who do not wish the parents to be aware of the situation. And there have been some very tragic cases because, you know, these abortion providers, with rare exceptions, they don't know anything about the girl. They could care less. She comes in, they've never seen her before. They know nothing about her medical history. The abortionist sees her once, which is when he's in the room performing the abortion. There is no follow-up. So there's all sorts of potential, aside from the loss of life of the unborn child, there's also all sorts of potential for the girl to be harmed and damaged. And, for example, if she has an infection or some other complication and the parents don't even know anything about the abortion, the situation may not be recognized and dealt with until it's too late.
I was encouraged to read in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today, headline, Clay will switch vote, back abortion bill. William Lacey Clay of St. Louis, representative, has decided that he is going to vote for this bill against his prior predilection on the bill. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think this is a recognition that the public is overwhelmingly in support of requiring parental notification. I mean, it's 75-80% in the various polls. And more people are paying attention to these types of issues. Now, however, and we do expect that the House to pass this bill because they have passed similar legislation in the past. The real test will be in the Senate, which Congress after Congress has killed any type of parental notification legislation. And we're hopeful. The Senate Republican leadership has declared that this is a priority. And already, Senator Frist, the Republican leader, has been trying to push forward with this, but I'm sorry to report that the Democratic Senate leadership is already engaged in obstructing it, particularly the Senate Democratic leader, Senator Reid, who the news media insists on declaring to be pro-life, but who so often is in the leadership on the pro-abortion side, and so far at least has been erecting procedural obstacles to prevent this type of legislation from coming up in the Senate.
How do you respond to two criticisms from the pro-choice camp? One, that state laws aren't normally portable in this way, and this would amount to making a law in one state portable into another state.
Well, it doesn't exactly do that. What it does is it's Congress standing behind these valid state laws. About half the states have enacted these parental notification laws. They have been upheld by the federal courts. And what we're dealing with here is large-scale interstate activity to evade state laws. Now, there are really quite a few areas where Congress is taking steps to prevent the evasion of state laws by crossing state lines. We could talk about various gun restrictions and so forth of that type. So this is not any novelty in that respect. And really what Congress is doing here is saying, you know, we don't want the state law evaded. I mean, the congressional committees have even collected many samples of abortion clinics using this as a selling point. That is to say, they will run display ads in the yellow pages of Missouri, for example, a state with a parental notification law, inviting the minors to come over to the neighboring state, which has no law, and using this as a selling point right in the ad. No parental notification required if you come over here. This is interstate activity, it's interstate commerce, and it is appropriate for Congress to deal with that. And moreover, with the states that don't have any requirement, the Congress is just establishing a minimal level of protection here for the minor, the young girl, and for her parents. They're saying that the abortion provider in the state to which the girl goes has to notify one parent, not get consent, although that would be permissible under the Supreme Court decisions, but not get consent. It's just requiring notification of one parent, or he has to see evidence that she's been before a judge in the home state. We think that's a pretty minimal level of protection when you consider the implications.
Another criticism that I heard earlier this morning came from Nancy Northrup, and she said that this bill would require a waiting period, even if the parents were right there with the child. If they cross state lines, then they'd still have to wait 24 hours. Is that true?
Well, you know, we don't think 24 hours is too long to wait when you're considering an abortion where you have at least one life being extinguished and with all sorts of physical and psychological implications for the minor as well. It doesn't seem to us that 24 hours is an excessive wait. Now, this would not apply, however, if there's any issue of life endangerment, because that's a specific exception to the bill. But that would, of course, would be an exceedingly rare circumstance. Really, these groups, like Nancy Northup's group and the ACLU and the NARAL, they are opposed to requiring any type of parental notification. They are absolutely clear that they believe the abortionist who knows nothing about the girl, never seen her before, never going to see her again, he shouldn't have to notify anybody. They believe that a 13-year-old girl, a 14-year-old girl, ought to be able to do this on her own, and they don't seem concerned if she's under pressure from the boyfriend or from the boyfriend's parents or any number of other quarters. That's okay with them. They believe that 13 and 14-year-old girls should be on their own on this, at least in the eyes of the law. And the polls show that the overwhelming majority of Americans disagree with that. It's like 80 to 18% think that there should be a requirement that the parents be notified. And it's really rather remarkable when you look at the public opinion and then to see that the Senate Democrats collectively at least are still obstructing this type of legislation.
So, Doug, how do we get the Senate to move on the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act?
This is going to be another one of those cases where it'll happen when enough of the senators, particularly of the Democrats mostly, believe enough people are paying attention. And we saw this in the last Congress, Todd, you'll recall, on the unborn victims issue. And there, too, 80% of the public was saying in poll after poll that they recognized the unborn child. They thought that the unborn child should be recognized as a crime victim when an unborn child is injured or killed in the course of a violent crime. And yet it was very, very difficult to get that up in the Senate because of this procedural obstruction by the Senate Democratic Caucus. But finally, when people started paying attention because of the activity of Lacey Peterson's mother and so forth, then all of a sudden the dam broke and it passed and became law. And I think this could be a very similar case, that these obstructions can continue, but at such point as the American public starts to communicate with their senators and say, we believe in this, we want this legislation, then it will happen. And that can be done in a variety of ways, of course. We make on our website some tools available to make it easy to communicate with their senators by email, and that's at nrlc.org, nrlc.org. But, of course, it can be done by telephone by calling the Capitol switchboard at 202-224-3121. And if somebody doesn't know the name of their senators or has forgotten, all they have to do is give the name of their state, and they'll be connected to the right offices.
Doug, two final questions, only 30 seconds
sure.
each. Yesterday we talked with Kristen Day of Democrats for Life about the so-called 95-10 initiative, 95% reduction in abortion over 10 years. It's a broad legislative agenda. Your thoughts on it?
Well, I don't think I can address that in half a minute because there are about 25 different parts to the proposal that they've made. It includes some legislation. legislation that we have endorsed before, including the parental notification legislation, and there are other things which are new. So that's going to take some time to analyze, and I don't think I could make a off-the-cuff reaction to something that broad.
Well, okay, then the second question, again, no more than 30 seconds, as your time is short. Here in Illinois, Governor Rod Blagojevich signed a rule at the beginning of this month, an emergency rule that require pharmacies to fill prescriptions for the so-called morning after pill. There are pharmacists who do not want to be able to hand this out. They consider it abortifacient. Your thoughts?
Well, there have been bills introduced just in recent days in Congress along those lines, and we are analyzing those now. We do have a process for analyzing these issues as they emerge, and we have not yet made a declaration on that legislation, so I'm going to have to leave that one for another day.
Doug Johnson, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
It's Doug Johnson, Legislative Director for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. Go to their website and check out this issue and many others, nrlc.org, nrlc.org. We were talking about the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act, nrlc.org. Now, we've only got a few minutes left here in this last hour of Issues Etc. We're going to be turning to a different subject, Justice Sunday. We're going to be hearing some audio here in just a moment from Justice Sunday. You probably read about this in the paper or heard about it. Or maybe you've even heard a little bit of it as well. Maybe you watched it when it was broadcast nationally. Now, when I heard the term Justice Sunday, I thought to myself, well, they're going to be talking about justice. They're going to be talking about this idea. Either civil justice or the kind of justice that the Christian Church wants to effect in the world. I was wrong. I think that the term Justice Sunday referred not to justice as an idea, but to justices, that is, judges. So, you've heard about Justice Sunday. There were evangelical and Roman Catholic leaders who spoke to a crowd of about 5,000 people, and it was broadcast nationwide from a Baptist church in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, we're going to be hearing some of this audio, and this is about what they're calling the so-called nuclear option, changing the Senate rules in order to allow an easier passage of George W. Bush's judicial nominees, ergo the name Justice Sunday. Well, the speaker getting the most heat of those who spoke at Justice Sunday is Senator Majority Leader Bill Frist. He spoke to this rally in a videotaped statement. Frist says that he may call for a revision of those Senate rules to end the filibusters of judicial nominees.
We will consider what opponents call the nuclear option. Only in the United States Senate could it be considered a devastating option to allow a vote. Most places call that democracy.
Now, the point being, two things come to mind. One, no vote has taken place on many of these judicial nominees. No vote whatsoever. Now, that's not exactly a filibuster. Plus, it's what one of our guests several years ago called a stealth filibuster. No one actually talks. There's no actual debate. They just fail to reach cloture, which is the end of debate, even though no debate is actually taking place. Now, the change in the rules would say, look, up or down vote, simple majority, 51 of the Senate. He's in or he's out. We'll vote on the nominees one way or the other. Now, Senator Frist says he rejects the charges that ending Senate judicial filibusters is a radical idea.
I don't think it's radical to ask senators to vote. I don't think it's radical to expect senators to fulfill their constitutional responsibilities.
It all goes to what you believe, how you believe the Senate's role should be played out. Advice and consent. That's what the Constitution says of the Senate, of all judicial nominees. And the real debate has started over what does advice and consent mean? Does it mean that they can hold up someone and not vote on them? Does it mean that they have to vote one way or the other? That's the real debate here. That's why the advocates of this change in the Senate rules are calling it the constitutional option rather than the nuclear option. Now, also speaking at Justice Sunday was Issues Etc. regular guest Albert Mohler.
This pattern of discrimination against those who hold deep convictions about human life and the institution of marriage must come to an end. We've got to bring it to an end. We've got to do what is necessary to fulfill our Christian citizenship to see it end.
I don't know if I'd call it a pattern of discrimination. I have nothing but respect for Dr. Albert Mohler as a guest on this program and the many things that he has written and said. I don't know if I would call it a pattern of discrimination. What I would call it is, what I would ask is, should they be refusing to vote on judicial nominees based upon their views regarding life? And I think Mohler's right in this sense, in pointing out that the real issue here is abortion, and the real issue here is the life issue. We can talk about someone's judicial philosophy. We can talk about their record. All of those things are taken into consideration. It is no coincidence that those judicial nominees who are not getting a vote in the Senate at present are pro-life. And that's what this is about. It's not only about these judicial nominees. It really is about a bigger nomination that's sure to come here within a year or two, perhaps even this summer. And that is a nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. These are the test cases. These are the trial balloons. Now, Dr. Mohler says that Christians have to be concerned about who's serving on the courts.
Religious liberty is on the line here, because the courts also hold, by their constitutional role, a responsibility to defend our religious liberty. But in far too many cases, judges have constrained and violated our religious liberty. And so now are some members of the United States Senate.
Okay, I wouldn't call it, again, I wouldn't go so far as Dr. Albert Mohler has gone there. Is it true that the judges have the responsibility of defending our religious liberty? Yes, without a doubt. He may be referring to something other than the life issue. I don't know what he's referring to. Maybe to the posting of the Ten Commandments in judicial houses. Maybe not. But I would point out this. Someone can be pro-life and have no religious, or at least overtly religious, principles behind it. There are such things. Now, they're rare, as pro-life atheists or agnostics. So the life issue is not a particularly religious issue, although certainly being an Orthodox Christian provides someone with far more basis for being pro-life than, say, being an agnostic or an atheist. Being an agnostic or an atheist, you'll be pro-life inconsistent with your beliefs. Being a Christian, you'll be pro-life consistent with your beliefs. Now, another speaker was Bill Donahue. He's president of the Catholic League.
What do? They say we're going to have a theocracy. They said the same thing when Bush got elected. We're going to have a theocratic state. What are we, the Taliban? I mean, these people, they claim to be the high priest of tolerance, and yet they practice intolerance against us.
And he's right. I mean, Donahue has nailed it. However, they are saying that religious conservatives, and perhaps even moral and social conservatives in general, are the Taliban. Now, it's one thing to stand in a rally and say, what are we, the Taliban? When there are people out saying, yeah, I think you are. I would much prefer to hear a considered and serious response to the charge than just, well, come on, we're not the Taliban. The fact of the matter is, there are many, and this is about the church, Christians, perhaps even just conservatives in general, making a case in the public square. If the charge is that ridiculous, then it should be easily and handily refuted, but not dismissed. Now, Donahue says that Catholics won't keep their views to themselves.
We will be disobedient altar boys. We will get involved in our society, and we won't be told to shut up and give it over to the secular left.
All right. Fine, good sentiments to the church has to obey God rather than men. But it does strike me, okay, I just want to think about this for a moment. If the shoe were on the other foot, and every time I hear someone talk about judicial activism, and every time I hear someone talk about changing the Senate rules so that we could stop these stealth filibusters on judicial nominees, I agree, we shouldn't be having them. But I wonder if the shoe were on the other foot, really, truly, honestly. If it were, say, just for the sake of argument, a President Kerry putting up a pro-choice nominee, wouldn't we want the option to filibuster it to death? Let's hear from two critics of Justice Sunday. Here's Michael O'Connell, a retired circuit court judge, speaking at a rally against Justice Sunday. Judge O'Connell says that Senator Frist shouldn't have addressed a rally that accused Democrats of filibustering people of faith.
Who do you think you are, Senator Frist, to state or imply that I'm not a person of faith or that I oppose people of faith?
Now, there are people of faith on both sides of this issue. There are. And there are some who, well, I might count myself among them, who say, just as a matter of prudence, if you take away, if you change the Senate rules on this, sooner or later, you won't be the one making the rules anymore. And this may be used as a way of literally rubber stamping people into courts. This won't be the last time some president has an opportunity to put someone on the court. And it may not be the president we want. Another critic, Jerry Lundergan, as chairman of the Kentucky Democratic Party, criticized religious leaders for taking part in Justice Sunday at all.
We must stop using the people of faith and their sanctuaries and their beliefs, whatever they may be, for political gain.
All right. And that's an old accusation. I don't know, maybe for me this is like religious themes on primetime television. I can't get that worked up about these kind of things. There is something far more scandalous than judicial activism, something far more scandalous than people standing in the way of judicial nominees. If Christ crucified wasn't preached earlier on Justice Sunday, if this bled over into the pulpit before the rally, I understand this is a rally in a church, but if Christ crucified was not preached in that pulpit earlier that Sunday of that Baptist church there in Louisville, a far greater injustice was done to the people gathered there. Yeah, they might have been rah-rah for everything they heard, but if they did not hear Christ and Him crucified, they were robbed of something far more important than a chance to see their nominees make it to the court. Something far more important. The word of life, the word of comfort for sinners. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be in Freeburg, Illinois at Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church from 3 to 6, our regular time, a live remote broadcast. You are invited to come out. Everyone who comes out will get a copy of a tape of our two-hour recent roundtable where we review Joel Osteen's book, Your Best Life. Now we'll be giving that to everyone who shows up for our live broadcast from 3 to 6 tomorrow at Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois, 612 State Street. That's Highway 15, right on the north side of Freeburg as you're headed into Belleville. Tomorrow, Thursday on Issues, Etc., you can meet regular guests, Pastors Matt Harrison and Pastor Will Whedon. While you're there, show up tomorrow. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.